Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this week's Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. We've got earnings reports from the likes of Macy's as well as Whole Foods and other information regarding a possible sell-off at Whole Foods. This edition of the Retail Focus Podcast is brought to you by Third Wave Water. Check out their website at thirdwavewater.com and use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order. Third Wave Water puts you on the track to brewing better coffee at home. We'll talk about them a little bit more later on in the show. But first, earnings from Wayfair.com, as they reported on Tuesday morning, and brought in more customers than expected, and this appeared to help both gross profit and revenue for the company's quarter. However, despite general bullishness regarding e-commerce, Wayfair still showing a bottom line loss. They reported an earnings loss of 66 cents per share, which was less than the analyst estimate of an 80 cent loss, but was still a loss on the bottom line. The company did, though, achieve an all-time high in terms of stock price after the news, as shares exceeded $60 per share. And I think, Leighton, this really reflects how bullish people are towards e-commerce versus brick and mortar, even though a lot of companies, very similar to Wayfair, are showing a bottom line loss and still struggling a little bit to show a profit.
Investors certainly were optimistic after reports came out about a very superb top line increase in revenue. Revenue was up 29% versus the same period last year, coming in at nearly $1 billion or $961 million. Trent, I think they're ignoring this earnings loss because of how much the company is growing here domestically. They also talked about increasing their international presence as well. But I think for the purpose of this podcast, we will be focusing on their strategic direction as it pertains to their business here domestically. And it is interesting. We must add that they don't just control Wayfair.com. They also have other U.S. websites in Jossen, Maine, All Modern, Birch Lane, and Dwell Studio, and all of those have their own particular niche as far as product selection is concerned. But revenue increases were largely a function of increases in customers and traffic, and you're seeing direct retail customers were up a whopping 46% year over year. So they're not only getting more customers directed to their different websites, they're getting more as far as conversion rates, and that equals top end revenue. And the one downside we must mention is that the average customer is buying less in terms of actual dollar amount. So in terms of a brick and mortar presence, we would say that this is the basket size, but this is actually a bad thing for them. But I think they can really focus on their product selection and boost this in the quarters to come through different marketing initiatives. But you see a statement from their CEO, Naira Shah, saying that we're thrilled about the momentum we're seeing in our business right now, in both in terms of revenue growth and profitability, but also in terms of the progress we're making along with key strategic initiatives we have been investing in for about 2 years. And when they talk about profitability here, they're talking about gross margins. They're actually getting the cost of goods down a little bit. As they grow out their business, they will be able to utilize those economies of scale. But they talked about the investment trend in their business, and that is something that they were mentioning throughout their conference call after the press release. And they're saying that they employed another 1,800 employees for the quarter, and the company feels like they really have cultivated a special culture within their company and bringing these training programs to their new associates. And they feel like they're now gaining from this investment. And overall, you see that this has taken off in terms of the human capital that they put in place. The company will be focusing on the creation of more product categories, and they really do see extended potential in the U.S. And what's interesting is a lot of people think of Wayfair as a place to get maybe a new TV console, a new bookshelf to put into place, but they were mentioning several times that they're going to be going into more profitable areas such as mattresses, seasonal decor, housewares, home improvement areas, and wedding registries. So a lot to take in here from Wayfair, but it looks as though they're not just resting, they're wanting to grow and grow fast.
As far as the wedding registry is concerned, we've discussed in the past about how brick and mortar has an inherent advantage in the wedding registry game because so many people do put off shopping for a wedding or gift registry until the last minute. But I think some of the categories that they revealed that were doing well for Wayfair struck us as interesting. Wayfair in and of itself is an intriguing company because they target both high-end consumers like the restoration hardware type consumers, but they also target the value consumers. They are more or less a direct competitor with Amazon and other similar websites on the value end of things. You think of Overstock.com, certainly, in terms of that e-commerce segment. The company overall targets households with an income over $100,000, but they've done a great job in offering products at these varying price points to try and bring in some of the lower income shoppers. And they see the total market opportunity in North America and Europe approaching $600 billion in the overall segment. So they're looking to cash in on what they see as an enormous market for home goods. We mentioned home improvement categories earlier. These are broad categories for Wayfair that can cover anything from simple fixtures, remodels, but also home accents. Home improvement was the strongest this last quarter for Wayfair in plumbing, lighting, flooring, and hardware. So specific things that you would actually think of maybe associating with an Ace Hardware or True Value or Home Depot or Lowe's or Menards, one of those companies. Wayfair starting to creep in, though, on that market share, at least according to this earnings call. And after looking on Wayfair's website, it's apparent that they do want to push home improvement. Home improvement is now the second category in their list of departments. It's moved up on their list on their website. The company is now selling or sourcing bathtubs, sinks, and vanities. And you see a targeted ad campaign for Wayfair on HGTV, on DIY Network, and on the internet feeds of those two television networks as well to try and bring customers in that might be interested in doing home renovations or sprucing things up around the home. After years of seeing the fruits from do-it-yourself retail centers in terms of profitability and growth, Wayfair sees this as an area where they can perhaps benefit from trying to compete with these other brick-and-mortar retail giants, and they address this much in their conference call, citing what they believe to be poorly merchandised home improvement items in physical stores, in existing brick and mortar stores, and in the digital space. Personally, I found this a little bit interesting because I know there's always room for improvement in terms of merchandising, but when you glance at Home Depot, Lowe's, and even True Value, starting to build out larger square footage stores, you see profitable stores, but also stores that are seeing same store sales increase. So it's interesting to me that Wayfair is citing this as a market inefficiency, something that they can creep in upon, because the home improvement retailers, by and large, are doing really well. More specifically, Wayfair cited design-intensive items like tile backsplashes, showerheads, and vanities as areas they might be able to include to try and bolster both top-line and bottom-line revenue. As we've talked in the past about companies like the Tile Shop benefiting from margins that are offered on a lot of those tile backsplashes, that type of thing, and vanity sets. And moreover, I think Leighton, more than perhaps anything else, they talked about branding, they talked about marketing in this earnings call, and what they're going to do in the future to try and emerge as a profitable company.
Wayfair's desire overall is to always be kind of in the middle between the supplier and the customer. And this is where they feel like they can differentiate. They can be a little bit more profitable, a little bit better than those other discount home improvement retailers such as Lowe's or Home Depot that have just been killing it in the last decade or so. But if you look at the things they are saying here when they talk about merchandising, they're really talking about the visual effects they can garner from their website. And they feel like their e-commerce play will be a key differentiator going forward. Even though Lowe's and Home Depot can have the in-store setting, they can set things up in a nice way to show off those bathtubs, the vanities, those kinds of things. They think that they can have a lot of teams work to bring it to life via their website. And I think this is a great idea because you're talking about 3D imagery, a little bit of a showroom type feel when you go to their website and you peruse their different items. So Trent, you had mentioned tile backsplashes, shower heads, vanities, those types of things. those things are showcased in such a way that you can see all angles in different lighting. Those types of things will interest the customer when you're looking at a website. It is important to really conceptualize how it's going to look in your home. It's extremely important. They're not offering these higher priced items for the contractor that's going to come into Lowe's or Home Depot and try to get the cheapest thing. They're wanting to offer a different style and a consistent look. This ties into their own private label brands, and they spoke about their what they call house brands, and they're going to have several of them on their website, and they do already, and they're going to offer a very consistent look. So while they have several different suppliers, how it's going to work is those individual suppliers, whatever they offer to Wayfair and their subsidiaries is going to be within a particular product mix in their private label brand. So you may be able to look into each particular brand and see different items offered from different suppliers, but it's going to carry a consistent look, and they feel as though this will be a little bit better compared to, let's say, an Amazon, where you have tons of different sellers offering similar merchandise, but it's not segmented in a way that makes logical sense. So they're calling this Wayfair's house brands, and now they say they account for roughly 45% of the company's retail revenue, which is amazing, up 33% over the last year. And so you're looking at this as a way to bring brand awareness to their platform, and it looks as though it's working. Again, using those 3D models via digital rendering and getting this brand awareness via these house brands, I think this is a very solid long-term strategy. Moving on to the grocery sector, Whole Foods is in our sights again after they reported some very positive news after their earnings call on Wednesday's trading. And Trent, this isn't necessarily positive financial news, but it's positive strategic initiative news. You're looking at a lot of big changes here with management and the way the company is going to go here forward, with a lot of competition in the organic and all natural space. And because of this, shares of Whole Foods were up nearly 3.5% in after hours trading and kept that momentum in early trading on Thursday of last week. And we see shares up around 3% as they ended that trading day. This gain was likely due to the context of the conference call where they announced some of these strategic changes, and not so much due to the second quarter financials. John Mackey, their president and CEO, said, "We understand that we need to do much more and faster. Our competitors are not standing still. We need to ensure our company remains a leader in this fast-growing sector." And that, Trent, really underlines what a lot of analysts have been saying, and that they are in a space that is getting more and more concentrated, and they need to stand out, not just with the 365 concept, but with conventional items that you need to look at the store level, such as pricing and merchandising.
It's interesting sometimes when you see an earnings call and you see the stock pop, not because of the financials in the earnings call, but because of some of the information in that earnings call. And a lot of analysts thought going into earnings for Whole Foods that if there was a stock pop, it would come based on some of the input on the strategic alternatives that had been mentioned in the past by John Mackey, potentially searching for a bidder or a buyer on Whole Foods. That wasn't necessarily the case at all, although they didn't necessarily mention that they were not for sale either. So they left that aspect hanging. But these strategic initiatives, I think, give us a little bit more insight on the fact that Whole Foods at least knows how they got here, which is to say how they got to a place of slowly shrinking sales and how they're going to move forward. First of all, Whole Foods announced 5 new board seats, a CFO, and a new chairman. These 5 board seats are replacing 5 current members who have effectively resigned. As we discussed recently, changes have been looked at on a wholesale basis, and they've been embraced as Whole Foods faces a lot of scrutiny from JANA Partners and Neuberger Berman, who are pushing the supermarket chain to enhance their financial position, or, as we mentioned earlier, sell to a larger operator. We discussed the rumors just a couple of weeks ago in this same space regarding Whole Foods and Albertsons, and potentially Whole Foods and Kroger, Whole Foods and an outside private equity group mentioned as possible interested parties, but we got no input on that front during this earnings call. Keith Manbeck was also hired as the new chief financial officer for Whole Foods. Manbeck was most recently over digital finance, strategy management, and business transformation at Kohl's. Kohl's has still had their own struggles. While they are profitable, they've been having a hard time adjusting with some omnichannel functionality, which of course isn't necessarily the goal of the CFO. So it is a potential that Manbeck was doing a great job at Kohl's, considering how much their sales have shrunk back, despite the fact that they have been able to remain profitable. And then you see Ron Shaich, the co-founder, chairman, and CEO of Panera Bread, also joining the board. But as far as Whole Foods is concerned, as I mentioned on the outset, they're not shying away from what got them to this point. You saw a big boom for Whole Foods, and then over the last couple of years, you've started to see sales shrink back. You've started to see expansion plans be put on hold. And the company says, now they are more focused than ever on delivering great customer service, and they're able to do this with that great work environment, that great atmosphere that you think of when you think Whole Foods. Of course, they have been very big about employee valuation since the beginning of their company, and they're underlining this despite the fact that they've let a number of people go, and they're trying to curtail their expenditures, at least in terms of staffing, so that they can increase their margins. They've talked about also bolstering their food safety. Whole Foods has been in the news over the last couple of years with food safety concerns. They want to make sure they're very transparent about their food safety initiatives, and they want to increase their product mix. And this is one thing that set them apart, is the variety of organic foods. Even the likes of Kroger and Aldi, who we've mentioned creeping into the organic and natural food space. When you go into one of those stores, you're only likely to see two or three brands, whereas Whole Foods, you might see six or seven different brands of organic food of a particular product. They are also committed to restructuring their supply chain and logistics, which is one thing analysts have been calling for. And that's one of the areas as well a potential buyer could help them with, especially if they have a supply chain already built out. They want simplified categories, something we've talked about in the past. They want to try and mesh things together in more categories on the store level, because right now their stores are divided into so many different categories that in terms of stocking, in terms of managing those categories at the store level, on the floor of the store, that's become very difficult. So they want to try and simplify those, and they hope that by cutting costs in these ways, creating efficiencies in ways that weren't there before, this will eventually lead to lower pricing for the consumer and draw in traffic.
And I think that's exactly what they need to be focused on, because me personally, as a shopper at both Costco and Sam's Club, a lot of the items that I buy there are organic and all natural, the same kind of items that are at Whole Foods, but at a little bit higher markup. So I think by focusing on that, they will be able to bring in a larger customer base, and I think that's going to help them in the long run. From the financial side, they did meet those expectations. They posted earnings per share of 37 cents, which is right in line with a Thomson Reuters consensus estimate. Also, top line sales of $3.74 billion did represent growth for the company, albeit some modest growth at 1% year over year. So I think this is a lot of big news, especially when you're talking about Ron Shaich joining the company and you see what he's been able to do with Panera Bread over the last 5 years, and especially during the last 2 years during the big Panera transformation, where you see them being able to utilize mobile and other platforms, changing the way they look at their business inside out. And I think this really transfers to the idea that Whole Foods for the long term could potentially still be viable with or without someone buying them. Their market cap currently is around $11 billion, so the company still is not a cheap company. We look at their long-term goals trend and how they're trying to grow annual sales to over $18 billion by 2020, and the underlying theme here was not only the customer service aspect for the people coming into their stores, but then also the shareholder value aspect. They said they want to return additional money to the shareholders, and they're going to do that in one of two ways. One, by increasing the dividend, and two, by employing share buybacks. And they said over the last couple of years, they've already brought back several billion dollars to shareholders. They want to increase that amount, and they're going to have a plan in order to do that. $1.25 billion into the share buyback program that just got authorized, and also increasing the dividend by 29%. And you see their initiatives, Trent, going forward. In order to be able to do this, you're going to have free cash flow. And they said because of the SG&A expenses going down, they want them below 27% of sales. They'll have some freed up cash. And they also want to see those annual sales hit that $18 billion mark because they feel like they can get a solid 2% same-store sales increases after calendar year 2017. But speaking about the shares, they were up on Thursday, as we mentioned, around $36 a share is where they landed. So they went up and then back down. Shares are still up around 28% still since the rumors started swirling about being acquired potentially by Albertsons or Kroger. And their price-to-earnings ratio is around 26, so a very healthy, optimistic price-to-earnings ratio there. Whereas before that 28% pop, it was around 17 or 18, so kind of in line with the Targets and the Walmarts of the world.
One final note on Whole Foods. After they popped over $36 per share, there was a lot of hand-wringing among analysts that wondered if potentially they were overvalued, if potentially they didn't see the expansion that their price-to-earnings ratio of around 26 seemed to suggest. And one thing I would suggest to our listeners is to make sure you take the negative news surrounding Whole Foods and that you would read on online news sources with a grain of salt. One thing that I've noticed as a trend, a lot of these news stories that go with the headline, Whole Foods can't solve this one big problem, or Whole Foods still has a sales problem, or Whole Foods sales are going down. Remember a couple of things about Whole Foods. One, those articles are mostly quoting analysts who have a target price of around $20 for Whole Foods. Sometimes it's hot in the analyst world to have a hot take, and in that case, those analysts are placing their hot take on Whole Foods. However, I think both Leighton, you and I think it's absolutely absurd to think that Whole Foods is going to be at $20 a share 1 year from now. I think most of their shrinking has already been done. The second part of this is that Whole Foods is really just normalizing in terms of top-line sales. You would expect a top-line sales shrink back after some of these larger brands, some of these larger stores have caught up in the organic food space. So this is a normal reaction for Whole Foods in terms of their customer base. And I tend to agree with the company when they say that they see room for same-store sales gains in 2018 and 2019, especially with these new strategic initiatives. And it wouldn't surprise me to see their top-line revenue actually pop above $18 billion before that 2020 mark on a yearly basis. We move on to our last earnings story. Here we'll discuss Macy's. A number of department stores released earnings this last week, including also JCPenney and Kohl's. Just about everyone shrank back. Nordstrom even took a hit after some negative earnings news, or at least news that was perceived as negative in the brick and mortar department store space. Macy's shares in particular fell more than 17% on Thursday following the press release. The shares are near a five-year low at one point during trading over the last week. All three key metrics for the company, same-store sales, top-line revenue, and bottom-line revenue, came in below analyst expectations for the quarter. On the profit side, earnings per share came in at 24 cents per adjusted share versus analyst expectations of 35 cents per share, according to Thomson Reuters estimates. This was representative of a 39% drop in net income for the same quarter last year. Total net income was $71 million versus $116 million last year for the same period. Of course, we talk about anytime you throw in store closures, you're going to see a top line revenue decrease. But I think one of the most concerning things about this earnings call was the fact that e-commerce sales didn't help to make up for falling same store sales. Same store sales fell 4.6% versus the expectation of a 2.7% drop, which in and of itself was fairly large. And then revenue, which was one of the key analyst drivers during this earnings call, also fell to $5.34 billion versus the estimate of $5.4 billion. So they missed less on revenue than they did on net income, than they did on same-store sales, but they still missed on all three categories. That led to a slew of negative articles about how department stores are suffering. But in this case, it looks like Macy's issues aren't necessarily driven by traffic, but are driven, more importantly, by high inventory levels and are driven by an adjustment period in the company's timeline, not unlike that which JCPenney was going through about 2 years ago.
Yeah, and because of increased competition, they are also loosening up their purse strings, which in that case, you saw an increased marketing budget, which actually they were looking at the increased competition they were having and decided to market a little bit more during the quarter, but this ended up hurting their bottom line. Their profit was decreased a little bit because of it. So not only those higher inventory levels, but lot of competition, and they mentioned several categories that faced this increased competition. They said weaknesses in housewares were blamed on strong competition, but they said at both Macy's and Bloomingdale's, they did see some positive signs. Their sales were strongest in women's apparel, mostly in active and dresses, fine jewelry, fragrances, women's shoes, furniture, and mattresses. Mattresses coming up in another company here. Overall, they are going to be focused on a differentiated strategy, Trent. They're looking to have an off-price strategy going forward, and they have what's called Macy's Backstage. And so far, they've currently opened 26 of these store-within-a-store concepts, and these are some cheaper items that you can find within a Macy's. They didn't say the average square footage of these store-within-a-store concepts, but I would imagine it is fairly large. They said they plan to open 19 more throughout the rest of 2017. And you're seeing that they are really shying away from Macy's full price concept. They said throughout the conference call a couple of times that they are looking to be a little bit different. And because of that, they need less store footprint. So you see a lot of pressure from activist investors. Also, in terms of selling off real estate, they have a lot of high dollar real estate. Several buildings that they still currently have are 5-6 stories tall, and you see them mentioning in their conference call that during the quarter they were actually unable to unlock around $96 million in cash associated with the real estate transactions and booked about $68 million of it. And they mentioned something we talked about on the Retail Focus podcast, and that the downtown Minneapolis location that they closed that made a lot of headlines because it was a very popular location that they had to shut down. They said $47 million was associated with the gain from that real estate transaction. And then on top of that, Trent, you have $9 million associated with the Brooklyn location. You're seeing these very high dollar locations at a time when commercial real estate, again, is only going up in price, so they're really able to unlock value. The one thing that we have to say to that is that if they are going to unlock this real estate value in the short term, we have to look back at other concepts that have done similar things, most notably Sears, which we'll talk about in one of our looking ahead stories. But they unlocked real estate throughout several years, and they created and spun off a REIT because of it. And you're seeing that they really didn't transfer that cash, that unlocked capital, into anything major. We're talking about another strategy that they can implement as far as new merchandising, a new strategy overall. But I feel as though Macy's is a little bit different because you're talking about a lot of stores, one, that are going to be getting more value to the company. Those are more higher priced locations, more high traffic locations. And for two, I think they really do see how they have to transfer their overall model. And I think in order to do that, you're going to have this cash. And so as long as they're putting that money back into the business, they're reinvesting in themselves and going all in on this off-price concept and their other stores, I feel as though they can really pull this off. And meanwhile, they are still profitable. We tend to forget that through these earnings releases, even though they're about 39% less profitable than they were a year ago, they still had that total net income of $71 million versus the $116 they had last year.
It is bizarre when you see news stories regarding Macy's and talking about the quote-unquote death of retail, and yet you have all these articles that are very positive regarding Wayfair, yet Macy's is turning still a pretty substantial profit, and Wayfair is not. They are actually turning the opposite of a profit in a loss. So again, I think there's a perception here. And one thing we always note to our listeners is e-commerce isn't always as profitable as it seems. Brick and mortar commerce is still much more profitable for retailers, even for retailers that are struggling somewhat with same-store sales metrics like Macy's. And you're absolutely correct regarding selling properties off. Oftentimes, activist investors will suggest the implementation of this strategy because, again, it shows up on short-term balance sheets, but long-term, it can hurt the health of a franchise. Now, in the case of Macy's or in the case of Sears, when you look at potentially spinning off REITs, you mentioned a Minneapolis location that was a well-visited location in a larger area of downtown, the Brooklyn location, same thing. You can unlock a lot of value, maybe not even selling off those properties, but maybe renting out those properties as well. And that's one of those things that Real Estate Investment Trust is in place to do, especially with commercial leases going up. I'm most intrigued, though, about the opportunities that the Backstage concept may provide Macy's. And honestly, the store within a store concept, not unique to the space. Kohl's tried it with Under Armour. JCPenney has done it with Sephora and also with some of their appliances in store. So it's not necessarily new, but it's, to my knowledge, the first time that a retailer, a department store retailer, and a legacy retailer has actually opened a store within a store that is in and of itself kind of an off-price concept. So far, they've opened 26 of these with 19 more planned throughout 2017. So it's not quite as much of a booming trend as Sephora was with JCPenney, but they're still trying it out in a number of different locations, and they want to focus on the categories that have given them recent success, not only in their main stores, but also within this Backstage concept. One area they're having weakness is housewares, also fashion jewelry, handbags, and we've talked about weakness overall in the handbag retail industry as a whole, even with some of the top of the line or luxury handbag brands, and also what they call the top of table business. Those things are starting to shrink back. But Leighton, as you mentioned, they've seen strong sales in other categories, and this is what they'll focus on going forward. I'm not so excited or intrigued about that, as Macy's has done that really for the last 4 to 5 quarters, said that they want to focus on the areas where they're having the most success. But I am more intrigued about the Backstage concept, and I want to see if they can parlay general strength in the off-price space into a brand like Macy's, or whether in the long term it will devalue their brand, it'll send more customers into the off-price space, and keep them from buying the full price line items in their retail stores.
As we mentioned, shares of Macy's were down a bit after earnings. They're actually reaching a 6-year low, currently trading around $23 a share. And this is representative of a price-to-earnings ratio around 12, a market cap around $5.98 billion. Again, I feel as though if you looked at their balance sheet, Trent, they probably have that much alone in real estate. So a lot of interesting news for Macy's as they try to shift their concept stores, and really looking forward to the rest of 2017 and to see if they can't turn this around to create a better story for their shareholders.
This week's Retail Focus is brought to you by Third Wave Water and ThirdWaveWater.com. Do you ever wonder why the coffee you make at home never tastes as good as the coffee you buy at a coffee shop? Well, let me tell you about a secret. Coffee shops spend thousands of dollars to make the perfect water for making coffee. And now for as little as 10 cents per cup, you can duplicate that magic at home.
Third Wave Water has a patent-pending formula of minerals that, when added to a gallon of distilled water, makes coffee brewing magic. Recently at the U.S. Brewers Cup Championship, the first and second place finishers brewed their coffee with Third Wave Water.
It is an amazing product, and Leighton, I can speak from experience when I say that coffee shops do spend a lot in terms of conditioning their water. You don't have to spend nearly as much at home. Check out their website at thirdwavewater.com. That's thirdwavewater.com, and use the promo code FOCUS, F-O-C-U-S, for 10% off your first order. All right, well, we continue the Retail Focus podcast with a more general story now, as Mother's Day is upon us, and the day represents an important time for many retailers, both brick and mortar and e-commerce across the country, as people are looking for gift ideas. As with most important and relevant holidays, the National Retail Federation has put out some spending predictions. The data is aggregated from a survey that's been running for 14 years. This is a unique study because it also covers areas in the service sector, whereas usually other NRF surveys regarding major holidays are product-based. For example, the Halloween spending we often talk about in the retail world. Lane, why not a quick brief history of Mother's Day for our listeners?
Yeah, the notion of celebrating motherhood and mothers dates back thousands of years, and I was doing a little bit of research because of the story. You see a lot of nations celebrating it, but nothing really formalized. And in the United States, the American version of Mother's Day was created in 1908 by Anna Jarvis. The day became an official U.S. holiday not that much later, 6 years later, 1914. It went on national calendars. What is interesting is several years after it being nationally recognized, Jarvis began to petition against how consumer-based the holiday was starting to get. She tried to actually remove the holiday, but was unsuccessful, obviously, because we're talking about it in 2017. But Mother's Day is largely celebrated on the second Sunday of May in the United States and Canada. However, in Mexico, it is celebrated around the same time frame, but it always occurs on May 10th. So no matter what day of the week, they're celebrating it on the 10th down in Mexico. Back to the purpose of the story, which is, funny enough, commercialization. Here we're going to talk about the repercussions on the retail industry and why this story is so big for you and I. And that is because retail spending in the Mother's Day categories, and that's because Mother's Day spending in 2017 is looking to be up this year to an all-time high. Spending this year is expected to reach $23.6 billion in the United States, and this keeps on with the trend of expanding sales figures for the special day. As of last year, they hit a record as well, $21.4 million in sales last year, so they're actually looking to increase and expand from there. And Trent, the more interesting question for our listeners is probably, who are the gift givers targeting and what products are they buying?
This is fascinating for lovers of retail, which we expect that most listeners to this podcast are, because it's not all mothers or stepmothers that make up the gift receiving. In fact, they only make up 64% of the gift receiving, so buying a gift for your mother or stepmother. In fact, 23.3% of gifts, according to this NRF survey, were actually purchased for one's wife, so ostensibly someone's wife that has children. 10.7% were bought actually for daughters, so that would be from a grandparent's perspective, followed by 8.7% for sisters, and from there, the breakdown pretty slim. So most of the gifts are still given for mothers or stepmothers, but a significant number of gifts are either given to significant others or to daughters and sisters. Now, compared to last year, 56% planned to spend the same overall in the sample size, but 21% have planned to open up their wallets a little more this year versus the 7.9% that are considering paying less for Mother's Day in 2017. Therefore, you see a higher projected sales figure for Mother's Day this year as more people are planning on spending more than they did in 2016 and spending less. In all, spending has increased a whopping 77% since 2009. Of course, 2009, the heart of the Great Recession. That is a larger increase, though, than Valentine's Day, which has only seen modest growth of about 16% or so in the 10-year time frame. And it's remarkable because Valentine's Day sales in terms of dollars spent will be about $4 billion less than sales on Mother's Day if the projections about Mother's Day are true. And of course, we'll know more about that in 2 to 3 weeks. As always, we should look into the most popular items that make up the bulk of the purchases, not necessarily the money spent. And honestly, I would guess cards and flowers. Cards number one on the list at 77.9% of people surveyed saying they'll buy either greeting cards or it will be with an accompanying item. Flowers was indeed number two. Didn't have a guess as to number three. That turns out to be dinner and lunch. And then after that, gift cards, clothing, and jewelry were also popular. Of course, gift cards so popular now in 2017 versus their popularity even 10 years ago. That is certainly a burgeoning retail industry. Further on down the list involved the service sector. You have spa packages and nail services, manicures, pedicures, that type of thing. 24% of the purchases. And here, this category, consumers seem to be listening to their mothers a little bit more. This year, more moms, 28% of moms, in fact, said they like gifts of experience. So the spa packages, nail services, unique experiences, basically, for Mother's Day. This is up from 24% last year. So you see about a 1/6 increase in this metric of mothers saying they would like the gifts of experience for Mother's Day. And I'll be anxious to see if consumers come up with larger expenditures in the service sector when compared with last year. But nothing out of the ordinary here with Mother's Day. Very easy to guess what some of the larger categories might be when you compare it with other sentimental holidays like the likes of Valentine's Day.
Yeah, and you see a slightly larger mix of gifts, and I think that is one of the reasons that average spending for 2017 is projected to go up. They're saying that the average person that is going to be buying something for Mother's Day is going to spend around $186. This compares to 172 in 2016. And now, who's to benefit retail-wise? Because this is the whole reason we have the podcast. We have to look at what retailers are really trying to offer their consumers something special for Mother's Day, and how are they going to be able to get a profit from that? Well, specialty retailer 1-800-Flowers, and we had covered, I believe, their second quarter earnings call. They've come out with a very good offer, and you go on their website and they're promoting the Mother's Day celebration quite a bit. They're offering a lot of discounts and specialty bouquets and gift arrangements, and this is the time to get long-term customers. If you are the retailer, either within the brick and mortar space, if you're just a mom and pop that you have a brick and mortar store where you're selling flowers, it's the opportunity here to execute well, because this is the one time a year where you have people coming in that may have not shopped at your store before. And I think this is going to involve, for them at least, 1-800-Flowers, a little bit more server capacity, because you're getting a lot more customers to your e-commerce platforms, but also the inventory preparation needs to be in place. And this is something they had talked about during the last couple of their earnings calls, are bigger partnerships with the people that put these bouquets together, and the ones that are able to acquire the goods that go into these gift baskets. And I think that's extremely important, because you're looking at something that is very labor intensive. Putting these things together isn't necessarily an automated process. A lot of people are talking about robots are the future, but robots are not actually putting together gift baskets. They're people that are thinking about what a mother may like, and they're putting it all together in proper time. So overall, you're seeing that in a basic Google search, I did a basic Google search for Mother's Day sales, you're seeing several known retailers really trying to advertise the day and get dollars spent at their website. JCPenney, Kay Jewelers, Macy's, Target, Kohl's, Walmart, and of course Amazon all came up in my particular search in that order. Granted, my search is probably going to be a little bit more tailored to what I've looked at in the past as far as online merchants are concerned, but it appears that retailers are using the day to advertise services they've already been having over the past several years. For instance, free shipping. Both Kohl's and Amazon were advertising their free shipping after a certain dollar amount. And then lastly, as a fun fact I had looked up, consumer spending is roughly 71% of the United States GDP. And last year, GDP hit an $18.5 trillion number, meaning that consumer spending is approximately $13 trillion each year. Mother's Day, if you break that down, Trent, that $23 billion in estimated sales, Mother's Day spending is 2/10,000 of that. So still a fairly small portion as far as consumer spending. I just wanted to bring in the big macro to get a perspective on those overall sales figures.
And I was intrigued on your Google search regarding Mother's Day sales. So I actually conducted the search on three public computers, and in each one, JCPenney, Kay Jewelers, and Target were in the top three. They were all in different orders. So those three kind of winning the search engine optimization game and the marketing game. We'll see if it pays off in their earnings reports for their next quarter.
Well, our last story has to do with supermarket chain Marsh, as they've filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy after some financial woes, and they are now seeking a buyer to take over operations for their remaining locations. The bankruptcy was announced on Thursday morning, May 11th, that was. They are planning to close 16 locations within the next 60 days or so, but could close all of their stores if a buyer for their whole operation is not found. The 16 stores will affect approximately 1,450 employees, with a mix of both part-time and full-time labor. Currently, the company has around 8,000 employees spread across Ohio and Indiana. Those are the two states where they have their stores. The potential closures would come as an addition to announcing a shuttering of 19 stores that was actually earlier scheduled. They were scheduled to close this month. So overall, Trent, it appears as though they would just have 29 locations left if they were to go through with all of these planned closings.
Marsh is centered around the Indianapolis area, and if Marsh is unable to find a buyer, this would mark the second Indianapolis area retailer to close a significant portion of locations after H.H. Gregg declared bankruptcy earlier this year. As far as Marsh is concerned, in fact, about 70% of their locations are in the Indianapolis, Indiana metro. Lafayette, Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana make up some of the other locations. They do have a few locations in Ohio and on the outskirts of Cincinnati, but their area is fairly well defined because they're getting pressure from the north in terms of Meijer stores. They're getting pressure from the south and from the east from Kroger. So it's a difficult market that they have, and you can bet that Kroger and Meijer, as well as other grocers, are looking at this with bated breath, thinking about the real estate that might be available if Marsh files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And in fact, Kroger, one of those companies that I would keep an eye on, given that they have a penchant indeed for purchasing up a lot of smaller retailers. Before the Chapter 11 announcement, the company issued a WARN notice on May 8th for the employees potentially affected by this bankruptcy filing. WARN stands for Worker Adjustment, Retraining, and Notification Act. This is usually the first sign that we have that a company may be closing a significant number of stores, as this was given to a large number of workers in a potential layoff situation. Marsh's VP of Legal Affairs, Ben Habager, said in the notice that Marsh has recently experienced a period of, and I quote, unexpected difficulties and increased competition resulting in poor sales performance. As far as the unexpected difficulties, we'll let Layton expand on that. But increased competition, we've talked about it. They're getting pressure from all areas. And with Meijer beginning to encroach on that Indianapolis market, it's going to make it difficult for a chain like Marsh and a smaller chain to make things work. The CEO of the company went on to express his feelings on the matter of the bankruptcy. He said, and I quote, "While today's decision was extremely difficult, we believe this action is necessary to preserve the value of the business as we seek a sale." That was Tom O'Boyle, their current CEO, in a statement. He mentioned that they reviewed every alternative that they could have reviewed and concluded that Chapter 11 was the best option to secure some type of recovery for the grocer. Marsh has up to 49 creditors, estimated assets of up to $50,000, the smallest amount that could be checked on the bankruptcy filing, liabilities between $50 million and $100 million. So this is very much unlike the Strack and Van Til and Central Grocers bankruptcy that we discussed earlier this spring. This is a wide chasm between their estimated assets, just $50,000, and the total liabilities that Marsh has. And I'm not even sure that Chapter 11 bankruptcy would be able to save the chain, even if they are able to go through it successfully.
Yeah, and you look at some of those suppliers, they are fairly large, known brands. We're talking about Pepsi, Coca-Cola, Frito-Lay is just some of them, but they also had mentioned back taxes through Delaware County Treasurer's Office, among other districts, other counties that had been claiming some tax burdens on behalf of Marsh. And if you look, they were actually able to disclose around 30 of their creditors. And all of these figures, Trent, the 30 highest figures here were all in the millions. And so I feel as though now is the time to try to acquire a buyer. And they were really profound in saying that they need to be quick in this because they have a lot of perishable items. They can't just close down. A grocer has to go through a sequence of transactions in order to get things streamlined in a closing process. But overall, you see that the company, as we mentioned at the top, will still have around 29 stores if they do find a buyer. But if they were to find a buyer a little bit quicker, they would be able to prevent potentially 16 of those stores from being closed in the next 60 days. But you see that they actually had filed the WARN notice before the Chapter 11 bankruptcy, so it was kind of rumored that they may be having some issues. But if you go back in calendar year 2017 to around March, they had already closed several stores. And at the beginning of March, when they announced some more closures, they had around 67 stores. So if you tie that to present day, they've closed about 20 in the last 2.5 months or so. So the company has already been downsizing, and you see through a brief company history of the company, as you know, just not that long ago, in 2006, they were bought by a Florida-based investment company. They were family-owned since 1931, and it was a company that grew slowly over the years. So they're very conservative. They were very careful in their growth. Obviously, they started in Indiana, Muncie, Indiana, in 1931, but they had moved on to several areas of Ohio. And at their peak, Trent, this is what's most interesting, is they had over 120 stores at one time. And when Sun Capital bought them, they had just over 100. So very disappointing, and it really is disappointing. You see a family-owned grocer that has a big history in the region, and Sun Capital just was not able to turn the operations around, at least in the last few years. But I wish them the best. I really hope they're able to find a buyer. And I think a potential suitor could be one of those bigger, larger, publicly traded brands that we've talked about here recently with Whole Foods, one of them being Kroger. I feel as though if there's any white space in the area, instead of opening new stores, it would always be better to try to acquire existing supermarkets that really already have a customer base associated with them.
Yeah, and one would figure that if a company were to come in and attempt to buy out Marsh, they would only need to do so for essentially a song and a dance and pay off some of the creditors, and then it would be clear skating from there. At least that's what we've seen from prior bankruptcies in the grocery sector. If someone can come in and take over the lion's share of debt, they might be in pretty good shape to buy the entire chain. The only question is that cost benefit there for a supermarket company like Kroger, or potentially like another suitor, for example, Albertsons?
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final stage of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I tell you about one story we're looking ahead to over the next week or month, and we begin with Leighton.
My brief looking ahead story has to do with Sears CEO Eddie Lampert. Eddie Lampert's really known for not talking much to the media. He doesn't have a lot of public appearances, but he has made some interesting comments here recently. We're talking about the annual investors presentation, but then also a blog post, and now recently an interview where Lampert really has taken his communications to another level. Lampert blasted the many media outlets who, he said, and I quote, have rushed to conclusions about Sears' future. And he said, not only have these predictions been off the mark and based on incomplete and selective information or biased sources, but they have also been harmful to the company. And this is really something that he's been saying for a couple months now, and saying that really all this negative media attention has hurt their traffic. And I think that that's not necessarily the thing he may be looking at to see why Sears and Kmart have been falling in terms of same-store sales and top-line revenue over the last 3 to 4 years. I feel like they aren't investing the money they're saving. He keeps talking about cost savings initiatives, but we haven't seen true reinvestment yet. They have a membership program, but it's the same exact membership program that they've had for over 5 years. So I am curious as to exactly where they're going to be putting the capital. A lot of media outlets are saying that potentially some of the capital they're using from the Craftsman sell-off, they got $900 million from that deal, will help to reinvigorate their current store base. But the one thing I really have to look into is those pension payouts. A lot of their longtime associates are going to be drawing a pension soon. And I had read that Craftsman, part of that settlement for the Craftsman brand, will actually be used to fund those pensions. So a lot of liquidity issues for Lampert and Sears as they look forward to having a potentially rough 2017.
One thing that I would have to say regarding that story, let's assume that what Eddie Lampert said was true about the media being negative, about how it's affected perception and store performance and all that. You know who's to blame for that? Eddie Lampert is to blame for that. Leighton, you mentioned it on the onset of the story. He's a relative hermit as far as CEOs or leaders go. He does not speak much to the media. If he got out in front of things and was a little bit more publicly visible, as we see some other CEOs with brands attempting a turnaround, trying to be, maybe the media doesn't have as negative a thought towards Eddie Lampert as they do, but instead he sits basically in his Florida estate, is not very visible to the media. He has not gotten out there. They have had no positive public relations push whatsoever. And I was talking actually this last week to someone that works in the PR industry, and they've said, honestly, Sears and Kmart have done potentially the worst job of PR you could possibly do of a company in that situation. You've got a hermit CEO that doesn't really talk to the media much outside of the last 2 months. So what do you expect when the media reflects you in a negative light? Now, granted, Leighton, I would say that you and I are probably in the same boat when we say that objectively looking at Sears and Kmart, even though we're positive towards retailers, you don't see a whole lot of positive there. So overall, they haven't given us a lot of positive signs to talk about. Maybe one of these days, if they issue same-store sales deficits of less than 2%, we might talk about them in a more favorable light. But again, I feel like Eddie Lampert only has Eddie Lampert to blame. My story looking ahead is actually towards a related retailer in JCPenney, and they're really only related in terms that they have had struggles, and they've also had some negative media articles about them. But JCPenney potentially headed in an opposite direction. Indications are that same-store sales are up over the last 2 months, and even though their earnings report during this last week was less than favorable in shareholders' eyes, there is still a lot to be optimistic about. What I'm looking ahead to is JCPenney's annual Investors Day, which is coming up towards the end of May, and we'll actually have a chance to look in depth at what's going on at JCPenney. Leighton, you and I both have a few holdings in JCPenney so that we can see these Investor Day presentations and so that we can kind of be in on the conversation. And I'm anxious to see what further plans they have going forward. They've rolled out appliances. They've rolled out Sephora in most of their locations. Now what from JCPenney? Where do they go from here to try and encourage further profitability?
What excites me is that they really are utilizing their real estate. We had talked about Macy's having these very large stores. JCPenney is not so much, but their store footprint largely is above 100,000 square feet on average. But you've seen the store within a store concepts, not only with Sephora, but we had mentioned Nike. They're trying to pilot some store within a store concepts there. And I think that really boosts their brand because Nike is a well-known brand. It's an elite brand. And I think even if you're utilizing just 300 to 400 square feet to implement something like that, there has to be some positive signs for the company. It's making them more of a destination and to try to push out some other areas of their business, some other categories that have been stagnant over the last few years, and then try to bring in appliances where you've seen other appliance dealers such as Sears really fall out of the mall space. I feel like it's going to be a strong 2017 for JCPenney. And let's not forget, their last earnings call, they received a profit, a minimal profit, but one that was ahead of expectations. Let's remember that the management, they were saying and foreseeing a profit in 2017, and they actually were able to get profitable before their own timeline.
Well, that'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. Again, brought to you this week by Third Wave Water. Check them out at thirdwavewater.com. For Leighton, I'm Trent. We're looking ahead also to Food Focus next week, where we'll discuss a number of trends and topics in the food and restaurant industry. Check us out, as always, on Twitter at Retail Podcast, and we'll be back with more retail news and information 1 week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.